This is an ABC podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome to The World Today. I'm Thomas Ariti. Coming up this Tuesday, a cluster of COVID cases at a school is seriously worrying health authorities. Could New South Wales be on the brink of an outbreak? And some positive news, evidence that COVID lockdowns have actually meant people are gambling less than they would in regular times.
We found that nearly 3 in 4 participants actually spend less time gambling during the shutdown, with a relatively small proportion, only 11%, said they increased the amount of time that they spent. And that included with online gambling. Most people reduced how much they were spending.
Well, it's again a tragic day in Victoria, with another 19 deaths being recorded this morning. That's the equal record number of COVID-19-related deaths so far. There are 331 new cases of the virus in the state. And the bungled hotel quarantine program is believed by health authorities to have been largely responsible for Victoria's second wave of infections. And at a parliamentary hearing this morning, the Victorian Premier, Daniel Andrews, has been grilled on his government's handling of the scheme. Our reporter, Samantha Donovan, joins me now with the latest from Melbourne. Afternoon, Sam. Daniel Andrews is a man under pressure at the moment. He's faced an inquiry this morning and, of course, his usual press briefing. Is there anything new he's had to say?
Well, he's really been pressed again this morning, Tom, at this parliamentary inquiry on the hotel quarantine program. And, of course, the very tragic news of another 19 deaths this morning has added extra heat or impetus to this inquiry, and he's faced very close questioning. He was asked repeatedly about the hotel quarantine program this morning. He acknowledged that at least a significant number of the cases in this second wave that we have in Victoria can be traced back to the security guards at the hotel quarantine program. He was asked a lot about the genomic sequencing reports, Tom, and this is the information that has made that link between the guards and the current situation and the number of infections. He was repeatedly asked about the latest genomic testing, the documents there, and he said he doesn't have access to them. So he wasn't able to say if all the cases that we have in Victoria at the moment can be traced back to the security guards. The Victorian Nationals MP, Danny O'Brien, asked him if he regrets using security guards for the program.
No one wanted a second wave of this virus, but none of us have the luxury of going back in time. None of us have the luxury of pretending that the reality we face is not the greatest challenge we've ever faced. That's what I'm focused on. There are answers that are needed, and that's why a separate process has been set up to get us those answers. And then there can be a full accounting for what happened. I don't have answers to my satisfaction, and I expect to yours either. That's why we've set up a process.
The Victorian Premier Daniel Andrews, who's facing this enormous pressure at the moment. Samantha Donovan's with me. Sam, what's the general view at the moment about how the Premier's coping?
Well, he's certainly under a lot of pressure from the opposition, Tom. We heard this morning from the Victorian Liberals MP, Richard Reardon, who highlighted the number of deaths, the thousands of Victorians out of work, and kept pressing the Premier for an apology. He was also pressing the Premier on whether he will ask any of his ministers or, in fact, demand any of his ministers resigned, and he will resign. He mentioned there Martin Pakula and the Health Minister, Jenny Markakos, who is giving evidence to the parliamentary inquiry this morning. So certainly a lot of pressure from the opposition. There seems to be some support, quite considerable support for the Premier amongst the community. But the Premier, when he's pressed on this issue of whether he may step down or demand resignations, keeps referring to the fact that he has ordered an inquiry. That inquiry is to be conducted by the former judge, Jennifer Coate. We'll start hearing public hearings of that next week, and her findings are due in November, Tom.
OK, Samantha Donovan reporting there from Melbourne. Thank you. Well, the case numbers in New South Wales, they aren't anywhere near as bad, but authorities are on alert with 22 new infections in the state. And there's particular concern in northwest Sydney with a cluster linked to a school there growing to 17 overnight. Now, the World Today has attempted to contact parents who were linked to the Tangara School for Girls at Cherrybrook. They say they've been asked by the school not to speak to the media. The school has been closed. It'll stay that way until the 24th of August, and all secondary students have been told to self-isolate and get tested. The Premier, Gladys Berejiklian, had this message for schools this morning.
Schools, in particular non-government schools, cannot undertake those extracurricular activities that you do outside of a pandemic, and I can't make that message stronger. Whether it's off-site gatherings, whether it's mingling between students and others in extracurricular activities, we are in a pandemic. Every organisation, every entity needs to abide by the COVID safe plans, because otherwise we risk having a surge in numbers, but also we risk having new clusters, and none of us want to see that.
Well, Associate Professor Sanjaya Senanayake is an infectious diseases physician at the Australian National University Medical School, and we spoke a short time ago. So 17 cases in a single school in New South Wales being reported today. What's this telling us about the spread of the disease in New South Wales at the moment?
Well, New South Wales still has active community transmission, certainly not as bad as Melbourne, but the fact that there are a number of clusters in New South Wales means that it is still a matter of concern, and that the contact tracing and case detection has to be maintained at current levels to try and get it under control.
So it's been closed for 2 weeks rather than just a few days for cleaning. Is there something peculiar or different about this case involving the school?
Look, it's hard to know the inside details, but certainly if there is a concern about ongoing transmission within that school population, and there's uncertainty about whether it's safe to return to school, then I think they're doing the right thing.
So we're hearing that contact tracers are yet to find the source of the outbreak. What's happening now in terms of tracing? What are the experts doing to get down to the bottom of this?
Look, contact tracing is just dogged detective work. So it really is involves dotting I's, crossing T's, looking for every possible ways that someone could have gotten infected. And it, as we know from Melbourne, where there are over 2,000 cases where the source is unknown, sometimes despite that dogged detective work, you just can't find that final link.
Do you think there could be concerns that many more students are affected?
Well, certainly it's important that students are aware of whether they develop any symptoms. Then if they do, they should get tested for COVID. We do know that overall, from a number of studies, children are less likely to get sick and transmit COVID than adults. There is some data from Korea and northern France suggesting that older children, however, may be behaving more like adults when it comes to transmission of COVID.
What about the broader community? Because like many schools, we're hearing that the school is part of larger, close-knit families. Is there a chance that this sort of cluster in a local school could lead to a much broader outbreak involving friends and family in that community?
It's certainly possible, but again, what we've largely seen with children who get COVID is that within the household setting, they don't seem to transmit it as effectively as adults do.
School closures, they've obviously been a significant issue throughout the pandemic. Most of our schools are open again. But does this raise questions about whether or not we should be looking at further school closures now?
The issue with schools, as discussed, compared to other respiratory illnesses, COVID does not seem to be an infection where children are the major drivers. Having said that, if there's a lot of community transmission, such as in Melbourne, it is wise to keep schools closed, more than anything because not just the school environment itself, but going to school and coming back from school involves thousands of people travelling large distances and potentially coming into contact with others. So that's why it's reasonable in a place like Melbourne. In places where you've got a small amount of community transmission, it would be reasonable to keep schools open but have a very low threshold for closing them if outbreaks occur within that school environment.
Okay, thanks very much for speaking to The World Today.
Pleasure.
That's Associate Professor Sanjaya Sananayake, an infectious diseases physician at the ANU Medical School. Aged care, it's obviously a critical issue as the pandemic continues, and today the Aged Care Royal Commission has heard that in the face of a major outbreak at a Sydney nursing home, there are questions about where the authority lies between the Commonwealth and the states. Now, it wasn't that long ago on the show where we were reporting on the outbreak at Newmarch House in Western Sydney. It claimed the lives of 17 residents, and the Royal Commission's examining the outbreak to find out what the aged care sector can learn. Our reporter Rachel Mealy has been following the hearing. She joins me now. Afternoon, Rach. What's the Commission heard this morning?
Well, Tom, yeah, just on that outbreak at Newmarch House, it began in April this year and was finally declared over in June. Now, the Aged Care Royal Commission is asking all involved how it unfolded and what could be learned and improved upon so that those mistakes are not repeated. Virginia Clark has given evidence this morning. Her 94-year-old dad, Ron Farrell, was a resident at the home. And when the first case was declared there, all residents were tested. Now, she told the Royal Commission that she kept asking if the results had come back, but was told no, they hadn't come back yet. Then a few days later, she had a call with a manager at the house.
And I said, look, we're still waiting. We don't know what's happening with Dad. We don't know if he's tested positive. We're still waiting for results. And she said, oh, you don't know. And I said, no. And she said, look, I'm really, really sorry. He's got his results back and he's tested positive for COVID-19. And she said, on his record that I have here, it said that you were notified yesterday. And I said, no, we did not. Nobody confirmed with me that he had had a positive test result.
What was your reaction to that?
I was in shock.
That's Virginia Clark there, Tom. So you can see that perhaps there were issues of communications with families of loved ones and in Newmarch House. But it seems that those communication issues weren't confined just to that. Now, as you know, and as you've said there, Tom, the aged care sector is run by the Commonwealth, but the states run the health system and the hospitals. So when this outbreak occurred at Newmarch, there were a number of what they've called interface issues between the Commonwealth and the states. And not the least of those issues was the question about what should be done with the COVID positive patients. They use the words cohorting and decanting, and that means whether they should be treated at the nursing home or should they be transferred to hospital. And there's been evidence this morning that there was a lot of confusion about just that question alone. Who calls the shots? Who makes those decisions about what's to be done with patients? Now, this morning, those issues have been addressed with Grant Millard, who's the CEO of the aged care provider Anglicare, which runs Newmarch. He's testified that when the outbreak began, the roles and responsibilities of the various state and Commonwealth authorities were unclear. And he says there was confusion about decision making and even who had the authority to resolve disputes. And he spoke about a conference call where all the different stakeholders came together.
There was one of the conference calls on the 16th of April where there was a heated interaction or robust discussion about cohorting strategies, decanting, either positives or negatives. And this issue had been on the table, I think, for a couple of days. It wasn't being resolved. There was a high degree of frustration.
That's Grant Millard, the CEO of the aged care provider Anglicare, and Rachel Mealy's with me. Rachel, the aged care minister, Richard Colbeck, has defended the sector's response to the pandemic.
Yeah, that's right, Tom. The Royal Commission heard yesterday that the aged care sector didn't have a plan for dealing with the pandemic, that even though there'd been outbreaks in aged care overseas, and clearly there was evidence earlier in the year that older people were particularly vulnerable to the disease, a plan wasn't put together for how the outbreak would be managed here. Now, this morning, the aged care minister, Richard Colbeck, told Fran Kelly on RN Breakfast that there has been some planning and that it had evolved over time since January, and he says the plans have been communicated to the sector. Here's what he had to say.
The advice on all of these elements was provided to the sector and continuously updated in bulletins to the sector, in weekly meetings, sometimes twice weekly meetings to the sector since February.
Okay.
And I can tell you that because I've been involved and engaged in those conversations on a very, very regular basis. In fact, meeting with the sector personally or via telecommunications, weekly or twice weekly, to reinforce all of these issues. Things like requirements for surge workforce, things like resident screening and staff.
Okay.
All of these issues have been discussed with the sector.
The Aged Care Minister, Richard Colbeck. Before that, Rachel Mealy, our reporter covering the Aged Care Royal Commission. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks very much for your company. Let's head overseas now. And the US president has been forced to abruptly break off a media conference because of a shooting near the White House. Donald Trump was escorted out of the room by a Secret Service agent and taken to the Oval Office. And when he returned, the president told reporters a man involved in the incident had been shot by the Secret Service and was now in hospital. Barbara Miller has this report.
Donald Trump was in full flow.
We issued those executive orders and the stock market went up 358 points today. It's quite a reaction. The Dow Jones and the S&P 500 are now
waxing lyrical about the impact of executive orders signed at the weekend aimed at softening the economic impact of coronavirus.
The Nasdaq index continues to set new records. It's been up.
When he was suddenly interrupted.
Excuse me?
A Secret Service agent approached him and asked him to leave, which he calmly did. The president emerged some time later to explain the sudden move.
So thank you very much. Sorry for that. There was a shooting outside of the White House and seems to be very well under control. I'd like to thank the Secret Service for doing their always quick and very effective work. But there was an actual shooting and somebody's been taken to the hospital. I don't know the condition of the person. It seems that the person was shot by Secret Service.
The president wasn't taken to the bunker, but to the Oval Office. It wasn't clear whether the person involved in the shooting had made any threats against him. He was asked if the incident had rattled him.
Do I seem rattled? It's unfortunate that this is a world, but the world's always been a dangerous place. It's not something that's unique. The world has been, you look back over the centuries, the world has been a dangerous place, very dangerous place, and it will continue, I guess, for a period of time.
Soon, journalists at the briefing got back to the coronavirus questions and the finding that almost 100,000 school students tested positive for COVID-19 in the second half of July. Donald Trump says that shouldn't get in the way of plans to reopen schools after the summer holidays.
It's a tiny fraction of death, tiny fraction, and they get better very quickly.
Latest data suggests both the US weekly death toll and daily case numbers are falling. Worldwide, however, coronavirus cases have just tipped over the 20 million mark. The World Health Organization's Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus spoke just ahead of that milestone being reached.
This week we will reach 20 million registered cases of COVID-19 and 750,000 deaths. Behind these statistics, there is a great deal of pain and suffering. Every life lost matters. I know many of you are grieving and that this is a difficult moment for the world. But I want to be clear, there are green shoots of hope, and no matter where a country, a region, a city, or a town is, it's never too late to turn the outbreak around.
One quarter of the global cases, 5 million, are in the US, with Brazil notching up more than 3 million cases and India well over 2 million.
Barbara Miller. Heading back home, and there have been ongoing concerns about the social cost of the COVID-19 lockdown, with reports of a surge in alcohol sales and domestic violence. But there is some new research showing the frequency of gambling actually decreased during the first shutdown, even when factoring in online platforms. And it's led to some hope it could lead to permanent behaviour changes. But young people are still considered highly susceptible to problem gambling. Gavin Coote's been taking a look.
Graham Penny's gambling counselling service has been quieter than usual ever since the COVID-19 shutdown began.
Those that I spoke to were happy about the lockdown because they weren't able to play the pokies, and that made them quite chuffed.
He works for the charity Samaritans, based in the New South Wales Hunter region. When pubs and clubs closed in the first lockdown, there'd been widespread fears more people would turn to online gambling. But Graham Penny says it hasn't fully panned out that way.
The calls to the gambling helpline, the National Gambling Helpline, dropped off dramatically during the lockdown. They've started to increase now, but they're still not up to the same level as before, not quite yet. So I think the abstinence that the lockdown provided gave people a chance to rethink their gambling behaviour, and some of them haven't returned.
And these indications are not just anecdotal. A study by the University of Sydney now backs them up. It surveyed 760 Australian adults who'd gambled in the past 12 months and reported a 60% drop in overall gambling frequency. Sally Gainsbury led the study.
There was a lot of reports in the media about a massive increases in gambling spend. However, we found that nearly 3 in 4 participants actually spend less time gambling during the shutdown, with a relatively small proportion, only 11%, said they increased the amount of time that they spent. And that included with online gambling. Most people reduced how much they were spending.
What lies ahead for many of these respondents? Is there that risk of relapse?
So we did look specifically at these differences, and for some people, the gambling shutdown was a real blessing. People were using this opportunity to reflect on how much they were spending, on how better their lives were when the temptation to gamble wasn't there. Although others were saying that they were somewhat bored, they were increasing their gambling.
Those who did report increases in gambling were mostly young people, aged between 18 and 29.
The young group is really of interest because we know these are people potentially with less money in the banks. They're still saving throughout this really pivotal time in their life, that spending money on gambling where there's no likelihood of return is potentially problematic.
Unlike the first COVID-19 lockdown, which affected all of the country, Sally Gainsbury is watching closely to see how the second shutdown in Melbourne affects gambling habits there.
It's really important and interesting that this research will actually be repeated. So we're going to do a second follow-up wave of these original participants. So hopefully we can get some insights across the country, because as venues reopen in different states, we should be able to get a really interesting insight into what is the impact of availability. You know, when you do change that, this is going to have policy implications well into the future of what happens when the unthinkable happens and you do completely turn off gambling. Is that actually, a benefit? Where does that lie? This is going to have ongoing implications.
There's some evidence many people have returned to poker machines since other states began opening up again, with New South Wales Office of Liquor and Gaming data showing spending on poker machines was up 8% in June compared with the previous year. Brent Jackson, who's the CEO of Responsible Wagering Australia, isn't overly surprised by this.
Seeing people come back to the pokies particularly, I think reasonably we could have expected that, yes. Our concern is principally around ensuring that we don't see an increase in problem gambling behaviour. You know, we have some very strict controls in this country, and any move towards risky behaviour is a very bad outcome. And it's pleasing to see that the University of Sydney research isn't pointing it out. They are suggesting that consumers have maintained that responsible gambling ethos and behaviour, and that's a very positive outcome for the industry.
Do you accept those findings, though, that young people have been particularly susceptible to problem gambling, even during the lockdown?
We're concerned about that. It certainly isn't played out in our industry. We're not seeing that. Again, our big concern is around young people and underage people and those people who are vulnerable accessing illegal offshore websites that don't have any of the consumer protections that Australian licensed sites offer. They can target people with impunity. It's very difficult to control them, and there are hundreds of these websites literally targeting Australians right now, and that's where we're particularly worried for young people.
New South Wales gambling councillor Graham Penny shares these concerns about young people.
They're quite smartphone savvy, so maybe they don't go to pubs and clubs as much during the lockdown, but they're certainly active with online gambling. I think the 18 to 24 age group has about 3 times the prevalence of problem gambling than the general population.
He agrees it's difficult to regulate online gambling and argues limiting boredom will go a long way in avoiding addiction.
The data says that most people who gamble heavily or have problems with gambling do so at the loss of other activities in their life. So I think the more activities you have in your life, maybe sport, people, friends, relationships, maybe even study or work, the less is at risk of developing a gambling problem. So I think the answer is to encourage people to live more, I guess.
Gambling counsellor Graham Penny and Gavin Coote with that report. If you or anyone you know need help, you can call the National Gambling Helpline. The number's 1800 858 858. And that's all from the world today for this Tuesday. Thanks very much for your company. I'm Thomas Ariti. Please stay safe and have a lovely afternoon.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Madeline Jenner, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
The rage in Lebanon is white hot and building. A week after a warehouse containing 2,750 tons of ammonium nitrate exploded on the Beirut waterfront, thousands are joining growing protests demanding mass resignations and an overhaul of how Lebanon works.
Today on The Signal, the complex tragedy playing out in Lebanon. What do the protesters want? Will they get it? And how did Lebanon's crisis get this bad? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.